Hey, good evening, Truth Seekers. Malloy here on the Nova M Radio Network. Welcome to the program. Little program note, we'll be off Friday and all next week. We have three different prominent and excellent nationally known talk show hosts who are going to fill in for me. Mark Maron, Sam Cedar, excuse me, and who's the other one? Peter Werby, of course. That starts Friday night, and we'll be gone Friday night and the following week, and then back on the 14th. On the 13th, I've just been hammered to go on the Sunday morning CNN panel, and I've said no, and then I said no again, and I said no a third time, but I'm going to do it on Sunday the 13th, so if you're up early, tune in. I think it's around, 9:30, 10 o'clock. Eastern, Kathy says. If you are an independent trucker or an over-the-road driver who is not independent, it really doesn't make any difference. During the second segment of the program tonight, which should be in about 20 minutes, right after the break at the bottom of the hour, I'd like to hear from you. This issue of a trucker strike, I'm not sure if it's on or off, but I think, like I said at my little blog site today, a strike or a slowdown by truckers, over-the-road truckers, would seem to be the natural response to what a growing number of owner-operators is going through with this rise in fuel prices. And, of course, this is another gift from the Bush crime family to the working class in this country. We know what the prices are. They're up around $4 a gallon. Truckers say they've been paying over $4 a gallon for diesel out west and over $5 a gallon in Canada. If an average fill-up averages 135 gallons, that's over $500 to fill up one of these vehicles. Now, the increase in gasoline or diesel costs are not being made up by increased loads. They can't be. There's no way that this can be made up. Unless the driver wants to push himself or herself to the point of insanity, which I don't think any responsible driver would want to do, and try to drive beyond the limits set by ICC, where it concerns how long you can drive before you get arrested. But I remember when we came back from Chicago back in 2000, and I went to work for CNN International, one of the stories I covered immediately was a trucker strike going on in France. The reason was high fuel prices. Now, I said last night the rest of the world has dealt with high fuel prices for a long time because the rest of the world understands that one way to control costs and also to control the pollution of the environment is to keep the prices high. And the reason the prices are high, for the most part, are enormous government taxes, levies on the price of fuel. In some countries, they have a two-tiered system for like for over-the-road truckers. And when I got back and went to work for CNN again, that was one of the stories I covered about the French truck drivers who were getting to the point where they simply couldn't afford to operate their rigs, so they stopped. Some of them stopped. Some of them just would drive very slowly on international highways that would connect France with other countries in that part of Europe. And the result, of course, was pressure on the French population, which translated into pressure on the French government, which resulted in some action. Now, I'm not sure what American truckers can do. Like I said, I've been watching this story. It's on a strike. It's off a strike. It's on a slowdown. It's off. I understand, like so many of us, truckers, independent truckers, are in a hell of a fix. They continue to pay these enormous increases in fuel prices. And if they were to stop, if they were to slow down, who is it going to hurt? That's right. It's going to hurt the trucker. It's going to hurt the driver. So it's a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation, it appears to me, for a lot of independents and not independent drivers. And that's what I would like to have some calls tonight from truckers to get your take on this. And again, this will be coming up in a few minutes because I've got to address this the situation with these generals who have been testifying before the Senate the past couple of days. The phone number here is 800-989-1480. 800-989-1480. I think American consumers, and that is, in fact, every single person that lives here, have got to understand what the truckers are facing, but B, what we're facing, if there is a job action or a response on the part of over-the-road drivers. I don't know what the percentage is of the goods and service or the goods that we get in this country that are delivered by truck. I'm sure it's enormous. At different times over the past 5 or 10 years, I'm sure I've seen this statistic. Is it 60%, 70%, whatever it is? But this is one of those stories that's going to be blown right off the front pages. The truth is, nobody's paying too much attention to this. There is the political campaign. There is this horrendous situation in Iraq. There is the incipient collapse of this economy that is just staggering. All of this is bad stuff. It's not good stuff. It's not happy stuff. It's not woo. But this is a result of a lot of factors, not the least of which are 7 years of this corrupt, filthy administration. When fuel prices get to the point that they've gotten to now, when the raw materials, when the price of oil per barrel gets to the point it's gotten to now, thanks to Cheney and Bush, there is no other way to put this. Thanks to Cheney and Bush. They did this deliberately with their invasion of Iraq. This is one of the expected advantages that came to them, that the price of oil would skyrocket because Iraqi oil would be taken off the market. And there are not that many producers who produce the grade of Iraqi oil to take up the slack. The immediate effect was a spike in prices, and the long-term effect is where we are. Now, yes, there are speculators in the commodities market are driving their prices even higher. But Bush has done this, and when energy prices go up to the extent they've gone up, every single person is affected, and I just wonder how many Americans are aware of that. I have to stop and think about it. You know, I just know when I go to the store, the grocery store especially, what I want will be there. I haven't grown up in the Soviet Union or some place where there were shortages because of poor distribution or poor market market manipulation by the government or what have you. Bush and his crew have destroyed this, absolutely, utterly destroyed it. And I just wonder how many of us, and I'm not talking about luxury goods. I'm talking about stuff we need. Jesus, God. If you live in an area where you can't drink the water and you have to buy bottled water. I'm talking about food. I'm talking about over-the-counter medical supply. Just the standard stuff. It doesn't get there on pack mule. It gets there by truck. And if you want to know how critical this industry is, just get out there. Get out on any interstate at any time of the day or night, but especially in the evening. And check the number of semis that are just going this way and that way. And it's like, Jesus, I had no idea. And we don't. So all that to say, I would like to have some truckers call in and just give us, those of us who are unaware of the situation, a sense of what you, the drivers, are facing and a possible solution. I'm not looking to scare anybody or freak anybody out or say, oh, Jesus, here's something else, although, oh, Jesus, here is something else. But rather to let people know, American consumers, as Bush likes to fondly refer to us, American consumers, what we're facing here, how critical this industry is. And if you take these drivers and start hammering them with fuel prices that are this outrageous, what do you think is going to happen? I mean, come on. Commodity prices, retail prices, wholesale prices are going up because a lot of this is being passed through. But that doesn't include the driver, I don't think. So that's what we're looking for. If some of you guys will call in, I'm going to put you on hold for a second. Just for this next little 10-minute segment, and then we're going to take your calls. All right? Matter of fact, we may not even put you on hold. We may start right away as soon as we come back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. And my dear mother left me when I was quite young.
is wrong for the Congress to discriminate against Mexican trucks.
Yeah. Now, we're going to take your calls here starting in just a second. One other thing, it's not just here in the U.S. Do you know that the military in Iraq are being price gouged also? Ken sent me an article here from the Associated Press. Military units pay an average of $3.23 a gallon for gasoline, diesel, and or jet fuel, which works out to about $88 a day per service member in Iraq. That's according to the Associated Press review and interviews with defense officials. The U.S. military has something called the Defense Energy Support Center. It buys its fuel on the open market, paying from $1.99 a gallon to as much as $5.30 a gallon under contract with private and government-owned oil companies. The Defense Energy Support Center then sets a fixed rate for troops. Currently, $3.51 a gallon for diesel, $3.15 for gasoline, $3.04 for jet fuel, and $13.61 a gallon for avgas, a high-octane fuel that's used mostly in unmanned aerial vehicles. So, you know, once again, the U.S. military, the U.S. taxpayer, is just being ripped a new body orifice by these sons of bitches who have clustered around Bush and his family for God knows how long and just started rubbing their hands and salivating when this unconscionable freak decided to invade Iraq. More money being made. I'll get to that later, because if I get to that now, I'm going to go berserk and start screaming and you know, lose my job. Let's go back to what we're talking about here. Truckers in this country, in North America, I should say, because this includes truckers in Canada too. I'm leaving out truckers in Mexico because I know damn good and well, and so do you, that they're not paid anywhere near what American truckers are paid. I don't know what the price of gasoline is in Mexico or how it's handled. James is calling from Alberta, Canada, listening on Sirius. Hey, James, welcome to the program.
How are you doing there, Mike?
I'm doing all right.
Well, I'm sitting here in my truck on an oil rig, and I thought I'd give you a call and put my 2 cents in for
all right. Those
fellas down there going on strike. And I just thought that they shouldn't think too big and try and get everybody in line. I think they should concentrate perhaps more on the trucks moving the fuel.
Uh-huh.
And it will have quite an effect on everybody else.
Are you're talking about the tanker trucks? Just
I believe so. I think if they can concentrate on guys pulling over and not actually delivering the fuel to different stations.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I understand it'll be large corporations actually moving most of the fuel, but if that could be slowed down, it'll have quite an effect on the rest of the trucks.
Well, what about now? Am I right in assuming that most of those drivers are going to be employees of these major oil companies, or even the independent oil companies, but employees nonetheless? And
well, I would imagine so, and this is why I'm saying, like, it sounds to me, I could be wrong here, but it sounds to me like most of the independent truckers are going to be freight truckers moving food, and
right.
That's what they're talking about is, I guess, upsetting the cart as far as you're going to your grocery store and now you're not going to be able to get that head of lettuce that you want or whatever.
Right, exactly.
But I think if they take their trucks and they block entrances and they, you know, strategically park in certain areas and whatnot and slow down the actual delivery of the fuel, I think that's going to have the largest effect.
Well, if I remember right, that's pretty much what the French truckers did in their last big strike that I was aware of, which was in the summer of 2000. Now, I'm sure they've probably had more since then, because a lot of European drivers, it's my understanding, they as long as they can make a living, you know, they don't mind that they're paying $5-6 a gallon for gasoline, which would be the equivalent of $5 or $6 a gallon for gasoline, because it comes the other way. It comes in the ability to make a profit and to take care of whatever it is a driver wants to take care of, his family, his retirement, his kids, his whatever it is. Go ahead.
Well, I would just say, like, we've been living with higher fuel prices up here, and you know, you get used to it. Now, I'm in a really fortunate situation here. Like, I'll drive a number of different trucks. I'm on an oil rig, like I said, And because most of my work will actually be in the bush, like the logging roads, moving fuels,
right.
water, whatever they need, I'll get fuel off of the rig, you know, and that's going to be given to me for free.
That is, you
but I can't go back on the highway with it because it's going to be a dyed diesel.
Right.
You know, but while I'm doing the work here, I'm not paying for fuel.
Well,
once I get back on the highway, I'll be paying for it. And it's costly. But I can say, you know, fortunately for us, we've been weaned onto it, I suppose, higher prices over the years.
Yeah, well, I was going to say that's been my observation for a number of years, is that Americans have always had subsidized gasoline prices that kept it unreasonably low, while the rest of the world paid a more realistic price for petrol, gasoline, diesel, whatever. And as a result, when something like this hits, it is a little bit easier. I'm not saying it's easy, but it's a little bit easier for drivers or companies in other parts of the world. Hey, I appreciate you checking in, James. Thank you so much, all right?
Okay, can all I right. say one thing before I go, Mike?
Quickly, go ahead.
Up in Canada here in your political situation, I've kind of felt like a pre-Second World War Austrian living next to Germany. So I just want to...
I hear that loud.
I hope I haven't upset too many people, but that's how I feel.
I hear you, James. Thank you. We'll be right back.
See, here I am on the road again. There I am up on the stage. Here I go playing star again.
We're gonna do what they say can't be done. We've got a long way to go and a short time to get there. I'm westbound, just watch old bandit run.
What I think the president ought to do is he ought to get on the phone with the OPEC cartel and say, we expect you to open your spigots.
Yeah? Have you done that, Chuckle Nuts? No? 25 before the hour, we are talking with truckers during this segment of the program about the spike in gasoline and diesel prices that is really nailing a lot of over-the-road drivers. And I realize that probably the vast majority of truckers in this country are employed by companies. They're not independents. However, there are thousands of independents who are being hammered by these increases. And even the drivers that work for companies, these small companies that have to absorb the cost, how do they do it? If they're not showing a profit, they eventually have to lay drivers off. So even drivers who are not independent owner-operators are still at risk. Not to the degree, I don't think, that independents are, and that's the reason we've asked some of these folks to call in tonight who listen via, for the most part, Sirius Satellite Radio and XM, and that's who's calling us. Let's go to Rawlings, who's calling in New Mexico, listening from on Sirius. Hey, Rawlings.
Hey.
Welcome to the program.
Yeah, how are you doing?
I'm all right. How are you?
All right. Yeah, I was just proposing to your screener there that the strike wouldn't work because you were just speaking of these mega companies like Werner and Swift, which basically generate drivers at their schools. They have their own schools, and they just generate drivers like they're on the assembly line. They put them out in the market. If these owner operators was to strike, basically the new drivers who are basically sitting around half the time, the $400 a week drivers would basically fill in the niche.
Wow.
And I mean, I hate to put it that way, but I mean, I've seen how ruthless business can be, especially in the trucking industry.
Sure. What do you see as a possible outcome for these really independents, the guys that own their own tractors and figure out a way to make a buck. When business is good, they do make a buck, but that's not figuring these increases in fuel prices. What do you see as a possible outcome?
Well, I can only speak for myself. I know what I would like to do when I become. I'm a lease driver now. And so I'm aware of how the budget and all that kind of stuff. I want to look into hybrids. I've been looking online and that kind of thing. But as far as the outcome, frankly, I think a lot of them are just going to have to stop because I mean, the trucking industry is not as strong as it used to be. You see what I'm saying?
Right, right.
And a lot of these guys, you know, it's just going to become prohibitive because it's not just the gas prices. You got insurance. You have other factors. You right. know, you got the time away from home. I mean, it gets to the point where all of those factors kind of, you know, weigh on a truck, on an independent driver. He's just going to throw in the towel, basically. That's what he's going to end up doing. They got some truckers out there that are, you know, willing to take some pretty innovative steps to try to, you know, do things. I mean, they'll haul, you know, illegal cargo or something of that nature. But, you know, I see a lot of these guys throwing in the towel because, frankly, it's going to be the only practical solution.
What would be the outcome then for the movement of products around this country? Are you saying that they would continue to move, but they would be moved by the $400 a week employees?
Pretty much, yeah. Because see, I used to work for one of those companies, and I know how they do things. A lot of the time, these $400 a week drivers are sitting around. They don't get loads every single day. Mm-hmm. Now, as soon as those guys and the owner operators start to strike or what have you, that's going to, you know, make more freight available. And guess who's going to pick up the slack? You see what I'm saying?
Yes.
And then, of course, the prices are going to continue to come down because, you know, like I said, these guys, they're not paying these guys that much. They don't have a whole lot of experience. A lot of these company drivers, they simply cannot do any striking because at $400 a week, you're basically living hand to mouth. If yeah. you were to strike, obviously, you wouldn't have a job.
Right.
And the other thing is a lot of these owner-operators are probably going to be forced to become company drivers, you see.
I get it. All right, Rawlings, thanks. I appreciate what you had to say, all right?
Yeah, if I could mention one other thing. If any owner-operator is interested in hybrid vehicles, they should go to Google and type in hybrid trucks in quotes and also type in Walmart. And you'll be surprised. There are a lot of things that you can discover in hybrid vehicles. So they've got, in fact, just for an example, this has nothing to do with trucking, but the rail industry has been using hybrid diesel trains for decades that no mm-hmm. one ever talks about it, though.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I may do that, Rawlings, because I didn't realize that there might be something like a hybrid over-the-road truck. Thanks, Rawlings. I appreciate you checking in. Tom is calling from Missouri, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. Hey, Tom. Yo,
hello.
Tom. Hey, welcome to the program.
Yes, how you doing, Mike?
I'm all right.
All right, first of all, 2,500 independent trucking companies are going out of a business right now a week.
You're kidding.
No, sir. That came from the Independent Association president.
All right, who's picking up the slack of what those drivers were hauling?
You're going to take it picked up by Swift, Warner, who else out there? Central Refrigerated, Schneider, England. I've had an England driver come up to me when I was down in Fort Worth about 3 weeks ago and ask me what the secret was of backing his truck up into a dock.
Oh, no.
I told him it was practice. And I said, why? Didn't your trainer practice and give you any practice? He says, no. I just got in this truck after he left and said, do it.
Oh, my God.
That's the type of training these people are getting. There was an accident on I-80 in Wyoming last week. At least four bodies were on the side of the road when I got there. It was caused by a Swift driver, one of those cheap drivers thrown out there without the proper training.
Mm-hmm.
Highway 12 between Missoula, Montana, and Livingston, Idaho, Swift drivers are not allowed on it because they had one to two accidents on that road every month.
Mm.
The thing is, these people are not getting trained. The company doesn't give a damn. And what you've got is situations here where you're going to end up with just Swift, Warner, Schneider, and these other companies doing it. And it's the same thing that happened to the oil companies. There used to be a lot of names of oil companies out there when I was a kid.
Yeah, me too.
They're not there anymore, and what's happened with the price? And isn't the timing just right, perfect with everything about letting the Mexican drivers in? Here's another one. Senator Byron Dorgan, whatever his name is,
yeah.
of North Dakota.
Yeah.
About a month ago, he had a meeting with the transportation secretary. She basically told him in a lot longer statement, but, hey, I don't care what you think. These truckers are coming in. Dorgan said, don't you have one of these 19 companies that's went in this test program right now, cross the border, and the average problem with the that was on the trailers on these trucks was a total of 100 problems, 100 broken rules.
Yeah, safety violations and stuff like
thank
that.
Thank you.
Yeah,
thank you. Violations. And she said yes. And she said, why didn't you close her down? Well, he's decided to fall off by himself. He's no longer driving in the United States. And he said, and then Dorgan said, well, that's not a correct. Is he still not coming across the 25-mile zone? And then she said, yes. So there's trucks coming across from Mexico right now that are not fit to be on the road.
Yeah.
What you're going to have is a small group of companies who are mega companies like the oil companies, and they're going to control the market. You think your food prices are high now? Give it time.
Jesus. All right, Tom, thanks. I appreciate what you had to say. Take care, all right?
All right, bye.
All right, sir. Man. Once again, when you are, as I am, completely ignorant of what's going on in a certain segment of this economy, and all of a sudden you open the door a crack to listen to people who are involved in that segment of the economy, and you hear stuff like this, and I'm sure every over-the-road driver has 10, 15, 20, 30, 40 instances of stories, like Tom, like Rawlings, everybody else. To me, the revelation I'm getting here is a deliberate effort. Or maybe not an effort, but a deliberate outcome, a deliberate result of this will be the elimination of not just the small owner operators, the men and women who contract on their own with lots of experience, absorb the costs, make the profit, and haul a load, but also the smaller independent companies, the ones where. And I don't think I'm not romanticizing this. There are small independent trucking companies where everybody's in it together. You know, the company may have been set up by a driver and his driver wife who retired. They set up a company, and they're going to be hit. So, all of a sudden, once again, just like damn near everything else that is getting screwed up in this country, you start to see a pattern. At least I do, but that may be because I've just become a paranoid, psychopathic son of a bitch who can't even think straight anymore from all the crap that has come down in the past 7 years. Who knows? We'll be right back with more of your calls. I'm Mike Malloy. Ten before the hour, I'm just curious where Kathy's getting all these trucker songs. Good God. James is calling from Dayton, Ohio, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. Hey, James.
Hey, how you doing, sir?
I'm all right. How are you?
Hey, pretty good, pretty good. I just wanted to say about the trucking industry, it's just real bad out here right about now. And like the guy said earlier, Tom, it's just perfect timing on how everything's going.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely believe the next few years, Mexican truck drivers basically on the roads up here unless people stand up to it before it really gets out of hand. And
all right,
I've done everything.
What do you think should be done? I mean, where does it start? Does it start with the drivers?
Of course, we're the ones that's driving the trucks.
All right, what do you do?
First of all, I would definitely you definitely got to stop it. You know, just basically don't move the trucks.
You think a strike or a job action would work?
Yeah, I definitely believe a strike would work. If the trucks are not rolling, The stuff is not going to get to the store. People not going to get their little electronics or their food or their beverages because everything is done by truck. I've done it. You know, I used to drive a fuel truck.
Mm-hmm.
I drove a beverage. I delivered pop before.
How difficult is it, do you think, James, to get people to drivers to go along with some sort of job action? You know, a lot of drivers, don't you think, would be afraid that, first of all, they might get fired if they were totally independent. Every minute that they're not driving is money out of their pocket, right?
Yes, sir. Our country just came to the point where a lot of the drivers today don't have the balls of the drivers of yesterday, to where they was willing to sacrifice everything because they knew down the road that it would pay off in the long run.
Mm-hmm.
Today, drivers are worried about themselves instead of worrying about the future of their kids or how the country is going to end up going.
How much longer do you think you can stay in the business, James?
To be honest, hopefully another 5-10 years. That's how long I think I could probably last if things turn around. But the way things are going with Washington and people are out here not paying no attention to the truck driver, and we got so much stuff stacked up against us with the, you know, policing. You know, every time I turn around, they try to give you a ticket for anything.
Mm-hmm.
And they just drive people out of business and, you know, just have to go do something else.
All right. James, thanks, man. I appreciate you taking the time to call in. All right?
All right. Thank you.
All right, sir. Thank you.
Bye.
John is calling from Las Vegas. John, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mike. How are you doing this evening?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
Good, good. I'm fine, thank you. Well, I'll put my little bit in here on this fuel situation. I went through it back in the 70s. I've been in the business for about 45 years.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I'm going out in the next couple months. But back in the 70s, we shut down, and fuel was going up sometime twice a day back then.
Right.
And they finally settled on about 40, 45 cents, and it stayed there for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And I do believe now if the drivers all would just park, just take them home and park them. You don't have to block the road, block the bridges, get everybody mad at us. Just take the trucks home and park them. We go on vacation, and that would create a big fuel glut. And they'd have to do something with that diesel.
Because
as they refine it, bring it in, and it's got to be delivered and burned.
Right, right.
Used. So that would be my theory. But another thing that would probably work against us for a while until they got the message, we got a lot of, I'm on the West Coast, and there are a lot of immigrant drivers out here, mainly from the south of us.
Uh-huh.
And where me and a lot of other Americans will turn down a load, they'll take it. In fact, I've had a guy tell me that, we just see if we can find a Mexican truck. I said, well, that's what you're going to have to do because I can't haul it for that. I mainly haul fruits and vegetables and the food products.
So what you're saying is the shipper will offer a certain contract price, and if an American driver can't do it, a Mexican driver can and will take that job.
That's exactly what I'm saying right there.
But that Mexican Mexican driver has to pay the same for fuel, doesn't he?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, how does he do it then, John?
Well, there's not three or four we Americans living in one dwelling where the wife working and grandma and grandpa watching the kids.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how it's done.
So the drivers that you're referring to can take a much smaller profit, assuming there that ultimately all these long hauls result in some kind of profit, the Mexican driver can take a much smaller profit.
Yeah, they'll do that until it catch up with them.
I hear you.
And then here come another bunch.
Mm-hmm. All right,
yeah,
John.
But I'm not worried about it much longer. Like I said, I'm leaving from out here in about two to three months at best.
I hear you. All right, John.
I got something else to do.
Hang in there. Thanks for checking in, pal.
You bet. Thank you.
All right. Thanks. Appreciate your call. All right. We got a break here. If you're on hold, you folks that I asked to call in, we'll take your call when we come back. We will take the people who are on hold right now who want to talk about this, and then I want to move on in the next segment because there's, you know, another crappy topic to talk about. I do appreciate the fact that almost all these calls are coming through Sirius, by the way, which is interesting to me. I didn't realize we had that many over the road drivers who tuned in. Anyway, we're going to finish up the calls for the truckers who are on hold. What we're looking for is just your experience as an over the road driver, so you can pass it on to us who are not, so we can get a better understanding of what's going on out there with these fuel price increases. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. This is the Nova M Radio Network. Welcome back. Nova M Radio Network. Mike Malloy here. We are talking to some truckers who have called in about the situation they're facing. There has been talk of a job action, a slowdown on the roads, or even a strike. I've seen talk about it, and then the talk fades. It's not an issue that's getting a whole lot of focus on the evening news or on cable news, so I thought we would get to the take of from the drivers out there who are dealing with these price increases, these fuel price increases every single day. Back to your calls in a second here. This comes from Pete. Mike, another chord that strikes close to home. My brother Sean is a long-haul independent trucker. His family is in New Jersey. The hub of shipping and loading is in Elizabeth, New Jersey. The weigh stations have implemented greater tariffs on the trucks passing through. The offloading of cargo has imposed a fuel tariff. What he is facing is a cost that's close to working for nothing. And now at the age of 44 with two kids, the prospect of unemployment. He is close to losing money if he remains independent. Pete, and then as a P.S., Pete adds, greasing the palms to have the cargo loaded first is part of the business. The corruption is systemic. And that's part of the business, too. Well, you could probably say that about just about any business, but I hear you loud and clear. Back to your phone calls. Rich is calling from Pittsburgh, listening on Sirius. Hey, Rich.
Hey, Mike. How you doing?
I'm all right. How are you?
Oh, not too bad. Hey, I heard you talking about that strike that France had back, I think it was 2000.
Yeah.
They settled their strike in 12 hours because they parked the trucks right in the middle of the road.
Yeah.
and that's the only way you're really going to get anything done here because, you know, you gotta make everybody aware of it. And like you say, the networks aren't covering it or anything.
Right.
But if you got traffic backed up from the George Washington Bridge all the way back to the Pennsylvania line and people can't get to work and everything, they're going to say, hey, what's going on, you know? They may be mad at you, but they're going to know what's going on.
Well, you know, it was my understanding, too, that the difference with that French driver strike was that, you know, people might have been a little bit pissed off but they were at what the drivers had done to block their way, but they were more angry at government policy that put the drivers in a position where they had no choice but to do that. It seems like we are one of the few countries where we just figure, oh, to hell with everybody else, let me get mine. Can you imagine if there was a backup on I-95 that stopped those Northern Virginia commuters to try to get to into work in the morning? How angry they would be at the drivers, not at the system or the fuel costs or the regulations or the government that got us into this mess to begin with. They would be pissed off primarily at the drivers.
But that's why you got to have some kind of leadership. And you do that like on a Monday morning, and then Monday night you call the radio station, the TV station, say, here, this is what happened, and we need a central message on what the demands are. You know, the demands are all over the place. Nobody knows what they want. They just want to do something. Well, you got to have some kind of demands if you have a strike. So you have to have a message, and you have to let them know, say, hey, this is what happened Monday morning. If we don't get what we want next Monday morning, it's going to happen again.
I hear you. I hear you, Rich.
And also, I heard that guy talking from Canada last night.
Uh-huh.
He was talking about some of the fuel coming down here and stuff.
Yeah.
Well, you know, a lot of our companies are across the border there.
Uh-huh.
If he wants to renegotiate NAFTA, all them cars they make up in Canada, if he wants to keep them up there and not bring them down here, you know, he was probably headed for the United States to begin with. So he's got no room to bitch if they do send oil down here. We've got, what, 9 times the population down here?
Well, that's
and we are paying for it. You know, it's not like you're giving it to us.
That's true. That's very true. All right, now come on, Rich. Let's not start a war with Canada. Everybody else is pissed off at us. All right, thanks, man.
Thanks, Mike.
All right, take care. Take care. From Mayflower Mike writes, and Mike, I wish the truckers would give us a 2-day warning and then do the right thing, shut the nation down. Call some attention to the Bush-Cheney mess that is running our country. Go, truckers, stand up for your country and shut it down. Mike. I remember what Rich was talking about. Now it's starting to get clear up a little bit, that French trucker strike. He's right, it was a quick story. But in France, the government is much more afraid of the people. In this godforsaken, what has become a godforsaken system, country's still the same. It's the people running it over here. We're more afraid of the government. And they have made it that way. But in so many other countries, it's my understanding just from watching what happens, and I guess that's because so many other countries have a parliamentary form of government where you can get pissed off and force the prime minister out on his ass in about as long as it takes to for people to stand up on their hind legs and say, I'm not going to take this anymore, whatever it is. But over here, no, we're just I hate this. I hate this because I put myself in this too. I'm not setting out here going, oh, you people are sheep. We are sheep. We put up with this. We do. You know, if I got out here trying to get into Atlanta and got on 285 or 85 or 75 and tried to get into Atlanta, and there were 900 or 1,000 semis stacked up blocking the traffic, I would probably, well, no, I wouldn't. I'd be pissed off, but I'd know why it was happening. I would probably park my pickup truck and get out and go around and ask them if they needed a cup of coffee. I believe in that, but that's the way I was brought up. I was brought up in a union town. I was brought up with the idea that you don't get a damn thing from the bosses unless you demand it. The capitalism is not going to give you a thing. It's going to take everything you have. Well, it's going to make you think you're getting something. It'll let you get a mortgage. And with the way the mortgage setups are, I'm not talking about the mortgage meltdown. I'm talking about regular mortgage. You go buy a $200,000 house. By the time you've paid it off, you've paid $700,000, $800,000 with the interest. The whole system is stacked that way. The whole system. Back to your phone calls. Kurt is calling from Salt Lake City, listening on Sirius. Hey, Kurt.
Hey there, Mike. Yeah, I'm an independent driver, and yesterday there was a strike against buying fuel, and they even talked about it on CNN. But a lot of the truck stops, what they did is they actually dropped their prices just for the day, about 10 cents a gallon. And at the end of the night, I went into one of these truck stops and asked the clerk how business had been, and she said it had never been better. She didn't understand why they had dropped prices. just for that day.
Right.
But I know why. It's just a big F you to all of us.
Yeah.
And any kind of organization that we try to pull off.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you see as do you see any kind of an action with results on the horizon that truckers could initiate, get involved in, bring about?
Not really. I don't see that there's that kind of resolve. I don't see that people are that organized. And, you know, the big trucking companies are making too much of their employees. They're turning them into slaves. As the fuel prices go up, the big companies are paying about 40 cents a gallon less than the independents because they're buying fuel in block. But what they're doing, because they're feeling the pinch, is they are tightening the squeeze on regulations and workout and home time and everything for the drivers that are working for them. And so people are just getting the independent driver is more and more getting squeezed out. Thousands of drivers are going out of business every week, and it's pretty much the big companies that are going to run things now, and so there's nothing that anybody can do. And I just don't see that that's changing. I mean, it took decades for fuel prices to go from between $1 to $2 a gallon.
Right.
And then now Bush took over, and now it's like tripled. And I mean, the last 2 months it's gone up $1 a gallon, and the rates are not keeping up, and we're just going totally belly up. Right now I'm just running my butt off just to try to even barely survive, and I don't know how I can stay in business, but I really can't afford to go out of business because I'll lose money
right.
to go out of business. So, you know, right now I'm just completely in a sort of a desperate situation, pulling my hair out, completely frustrated,
Jesus.
And wishing I hadn't made this decision to go into business for myself, quite frankly.
I hear you. All right, Kurt, thanks for calling in, man. I appreciate what you had to say, all right?
All right, bye-bye.
All right, take care. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy. It's 21 past the hour. William writes in, Mike, it's a tough spot the drivers are in. They're afraid to react without losing what they have, just like the general strike that's always talked about. No one seems to dare to make a move anymore, let alone be able to organize something on a large scale. I know if this does not happen, in the long run, everyone loses. It takes everyone, or it's nothing. Yeah, that's true. Brian is calling from California, listening on Sirius. Hey, Brian.
Hello, how you doing?
I'm all right. How are you?
Doing good. Yeah, I just kind of wanted to give a little bit different life on this, you know.
All right.
I'm an independent owner-operator, and I basically hustle my own freight. So I have a few brokers, but also I just deal a lot just with shippers.
Uh-huh.
You know, and then when the price, I mean, you just can't go up on rates all the time, but when they get to a certain level, you know, you go to your shipper, hey, I need to go up,
right.
you know, on the rate. And our whole attitude when we have our just a couple of trucks is our service, you know, and where they don't want to pay someone else to do stuff for cheaper.
Sure.
You know, and just to kind of go with the guy was talking about the Mexican truck drivers, that's stereotyping. You know, you can't stereotype the whole race, you know, on the truck drivers because bottom line, you know, if you're hauling cheap freight, you know, I don't care if you're white, black, Mexican, or whoever, you ain't going to make it out here right now.
Well, I think the point he was making is not so much the man's nationality or the color of his skin, but the fact that the standards, the wage standards in the two countries, United States and Mexico, are so screwed because of NAFTA, that a driver from south of the border, whether it's Mexico or someplace in Central America, is in fact able to, you know, maybe to exist at a lower rate to haul something than someone else. It's the same reason you see immigrants, whether they're legal or not, who do the stoop labor in this country, who get out and harvest the field crops, which I understand is really in trouble this year too because of the crackdown on illegals. But I don't think the man was making necessarily a racist statement. I think he was making an economic statement, and I think he's right. Don't you?
If a truck's out of Mexico right now, he can only come 100 miles over the border. The borders aren't open up right now. That deal, it never went all the way through. You know what I mean? They can't come all the way. Say if he's in down by Tijuana, he can't come up to Sacramento.
Oh, I thought that had been changed. Hadn't been changed yet?
No, it hadn't been changed. It got close to being changed, but it got knocked back down.
Uh-huh.
But, yeah, right now they can only go over 100 miles. Believe me, I'm out here every day, and what he was talking about is what they talk about the Mexican trucks all the time.
Right.
You know, and I'm out here every day, and I know exactly what he's talking about because you hear it on the TV, you know. And but bottom line is, I mean, you just can't make it on that. But anyway, back to the strike part. I mean, just to show you how it just really wasn't real organized, because I never even heard about it till yesterday.
You know,
it was supposed to be half of starting yesterday or the first, and like the guy was saying, you know, we can stop at the, you know, at the truck stops and block all the lines. Well, you've got a lot of company drivers out here, just say like a Walmart driver.
Right.
You know, they're you know, we got two different families out here, you know.
Sure.
So it's like, okay, if all the independents stop, you still have all these company drivers that are, you know, the fuel price would be $10 a gallon. I mean, they're still rolling.
Right, right, right. Because the driver's not responsible for it.
Exactly. Yeah. So I'm looking like, and that's why with ours, we just have a couple of trucks where we looked at it as far as, you know, we've got some good customers, you know, that like our service, and
yeah,
we try to rise above it, you know,
I agree with that approach, Brian. I think it's like any other skilled occupation whatever it is. If you give good service, word gets around in the trucking industry. Sure, I think independent shippers are going to work with independent truckers who do a good job. I understand the idea of having to go to a broker occasionally, but shippers you eliminate when you go to the shipper, you eliminate the broker fee, don't you?
Right, exactly. And back in the day, the broker fee was reasonable. Now they're just giving you whatever they want. Now, I'm going to clear up a little bit. I do have some good brokers, you know what I mean, that I deal with.
Oh, sure, sure.
You know, but you do have a lot of these, they're new brokers, and they come out, and, I mean, you just say you have a load paying $2,000.
Right.
I mean, they'll take out $500-$600 out of it. You know, they'll take the fuel surcharge. I'm a flatbedder, so... You know, you get paid extra for tarping.
Right.
They'll take the tarping, and they say, oh, it's all included. Because all it takes now to become a broker is $1,000 and to put up for a $10,000 bond. So,
yeah,
to me right now, there's so many new brokers coming into the game that's worse than the fuel prices for independent
Okay, let me ask you a 30-second answer here because I got a break. What's going to happen? What's going to happen?
Oh, I mean, it's just gonna this story is gonna go over. I mean, a few guys might go under, but I think that the ones that keep hanging on, it'll. I mean, you just got to keep pressing on. You know, you just can't give up. You know, I'm like, you hear some of these guys saying, "Oh, a couple of years." That attitude. I get out and hustle. You got to be a driver plus a marketing.
I
got to have both of them. You just can't be out here driving.
All right,
get out there and market.
All right, I got you, Brian. Thank you. I appreciate you checking in. All right.
All right, appreciate it.
All right, take care. What Brian just said, it sounds like, you know, once again, and I know where Brian's coming from, trust me, but it sounds like, once again, it's a survival situation rather than a situation where you can, you know, really grow your business. I don't know. We'll be right back. I'm Mike Malloy.
Those big old wheels keep rolling through my mind.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly. all your life. You were only waiting for this moment to arise.
You're listening to Mike Malloy on Luther AM Radio. Turn down your speakers. It'll be our secret.
Take these sunken eyes and learn.
It's about 25 before the hour. All right, last call on this, on the truckers' situation. Last call tonight. Let's go to Dan, who's calling from Minnesota, listening on Sirius. Hey, Dan.
Hey, Mike. How you doing?
I'm all right. How are you?
I love your show, man.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
The last caller pretty much kind of pointed out a little bit, but it's mainly the broker. That's the problem that's going on here, the broker. The middleman is always the problem. Whatever business endeavor you look at, the middleman.
Well, educate me. Isn't it true, though, that without the broker, independent drivers would have to just scramble like hell to try to find jobs, right?
No, not really. Independent contractor can go straight to the shipper and get it. But with the broker in the middle, you can't. He's blocking the road from getting through it.
I
know this broker is probably listening to what I'm saying, and I know they don't like it, but that's the fact. The broker would negotiate with your price.
Uh-huh. The broker would negotiate with your price? Yeah, he said negotiate with. Is that what you said, Dan? That the
broker, right.
Would negotiate your price?
Right, exactly.
Okay.
Let's say the load cost $4,000 and I decline it. He'll call me back and tell me, okay, how about $5,000?
Right.
I say no. And then he'll call me back and say about $550.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's supposed to take 10% off of that load. But you would never know how much that load costs. I'll give you an example. I was talking to these drivers one time. They hauled musical instruments. And they had talked to the owner one time. They were sitting because they were helping out unloading the musical instruments. And they said, hey, guys, let's go eat. And they were just chit-chatting with him. And they asked him, you know, how much does the broker charge?
Right.
He told them $25,000. And the driver just couldn't believe it because they were getting paid $6,000 to do all that work.
Oh my God.
It's the broker that's causing the problem. Even the real estate, you can, you know, somebody buying a house, you have to go through the middleman.
The middleman
is all the mafia. The problem is the middleman.
That's well, in the way you're putting it, you're absolutely right. And a lot of people do sell their houses without a broker for sure. All right. Well, I think that's another cog in the wheel, Dan. Just one more load that a trucker, I don't mean to be funny here, but one more load a trucker has to bear in addition to all these other increases in costs. Dan, thanks, man. I got to move on. I appreciate what you had to say. And thanks to everybody who called in with your point of view on this. It's not, like one of our callers said, it's not going to go away. It's not something that's going to go away. As this situation develops or changes or whatever, we'll do our best on this program to, how do they say it in the big leagues, bring you updates as to what's going on. Thanks a lot to the people who called in. The other item tonight that I think really needs some attention, testimony that is occurring before several Senate committees. One is the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and the other is the Senate Armed Services Committee. This is all in preparation for the appearance of two generals, Odierno, the number two guy, and Petraeus, the number one guy, as far as the military is concerned, in Iraq. Both of these generals are due to appear. I know Petraeus, I think, is next week. I don't know if Odierno is tomorrow or next week also. But William Odom, who is a retired lieutenant general, three-star general, former commander of U.S. forces in Europe, went before the Senate, what committee was this, Kathy? The Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Let me just quote a few things he said. This was his second time appearing. He said the last occasion was in January 2007 when the topic was the troop surge. Today you are asking if it has worked. Last year I rejected the claim that it was a new strategy. Rather, I said, it is a new tactic used to achieve the same old strategic aim, political stability. And I foresaw no serious prospects for success. I see no reason to change my judgment now. The surge is prolonging instability, not creating the conditions for unity as the president claims. He goes on to say, violence has been temporarily reduced, but today there is credible evidence that the political situation is far more fragmented, and currently we are seeing violence surge in Baghdad and Basra. In fact, it has also remained sporadic and significant in several other parts of Iraq over the past year. More disturbing, General Odom says, Prime Minister Maliki has initiated military action and then dragged in U.S. forces to help his own troops destroy his Shiite competitors. This is a political setback, not a political solution. Such is the result of the surge tactic, he says. He adds this, tuning to the apparent success in Anbar province and a few other Sunni areas, this is not the positive situation it is purported to be. Certainly violence has declined as local Sunni sheikhs have begun to cooperate with U.S. forces, but the surge tactic cannot be given the credit. The decline started earlier on Sunni initiative. What are their motives? First, now listen up, anger at Al-Qaeda operatives, and second, their financial plight. The break with Al-Qaeda should give us little comfort. The Sunnis welcome anyone would help them kill Americans, including Al-Qaeda. The concern we hear the president and his aides express about a residual base left for Al-Qaeda if we withdraw is utter nonsense. The Sunnis will destroy Al-Qaeda if we leave Iraq. The Kurds do not allow them in their region. And the Shiites, like the Iranians, detest Al-Qaeda. Jesus. Let me emphasize, General Odom says, that our new Sunni friends insist on being paid for their loyalty. I've heard, for example, a rough estimate that the cost in one area of about 1,000 square kilometers is $250,000 per day. And periodically they threaten to defect unless their fees are increased. And then he goes on, this can hardly be called greater military stability in Iraq, much less progress toward political consolidation. And to call it fragility that needs more time to become success is to ignore the implications. What we are witnessing is more accurately described as the road to the Balkanization of Iraq, that is, political fragmentation. We are being asked by the president to believe that this shift of so much power and finance to so many local chieftains is the road to political centralization. He describes the process as building the state from the bottom up. I challenge you to press the administration's witnesses this week to explain this absurdity. Ask them to name a single historical case where power has been aggregated successfully from local strongmen to a central government except through bloody violence leading to a single winner. Most often a dictator. That is the history of feudal Europe's transformation to the age of absolute monarchy. It is the story of American colonization of the West and our Civil War. It took England 800 years to subdue clan rule on what is now the English-Scottish border. And it is the source of violence in Bosnia and Kosovo. How can our leaders celebrate this diffusion of power as effective state building? More actively described, it has placed the United States astride several civil wars. To sum up, General Odom says, we face a deteriorating political situation with an overextended army. The only sensible strategy is to withdraw rapidly, but in good order. Only that step can break the paralysis now gripping U.S. strategy in the region. The next step is to choose a new aim, regional stability, not a meaningless victory in Iraq. And progress toward that goal requires revising our policy toward Iran. If the president merely renounced his threat of regime change by force, that could prompt Iran to lessen its support to Taliban groups in Afghanistan. Iran detests the Taliban and supports them only because they will kill more Americans in Afghanistan as retaliation in event of a U.S. attack on Iran. Now, there's more here, but we're coming up on a break. These are tacticians. This is a lieutenant general. This is a three-star general who's retired, who is sitting there telling the members of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee that George W. Bush and these filthy rat bastards who have got us into this mess have got us into this mess. The strategy is wrong. The tactics are wrong. The entire overview is wrong. But you and I knew this. Of course, we knew this 6 years ago, didn't we? Before this debacle started. But here they sit, one after another. The next one is General, and he's active services, General Cody, Richard Cody, the Army's Chief of Staff, Vice Chief of Staff. I'll have some more of this when we come back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. The good life was so elusive. Handouts, they got me down. I had to regain my confidence, so I got into camouflage. The girls, they love to see you shoot. I love a man in uniform. I love a man in uniform.
Of the 21st century, and there's universal approval of the statements I have made, and I'm confident there will be universal approval of the actions this government takes.
You miserable little pissant. Universal approval? God. Back to the testimony here quickly. A statement today by William Odom, Lieutenant General, United States Army, retired, former commander of U.S. forces in Europe. He, along with some other senior officers, both active duty and retired, have been asked to testify prior to the questions going to be asked of General Petraeus and General Odierno about what the hell is going on in Iraq. Now, of course, Petraeus, and to a lesser degree Odierno, being the apple polishers, the butt kissers that they are, where it concerns civilian leadership. And I'm not talking about chain of command here. I'm talking about these guys are jerks. Anybody in the military with any understanding of them will tell you the same thing. Odierno to a lesser degree, but certainly Petraeus. And that's not me talking. That's what the general consensus is in the officer corps, especially about Petraeus. But they will sit there and tell these members of the Senate crap when they show up for their testimony. So one of the reasons that they're having this testimony prior to Petraeus and Odierno is so the senators have something they can come back with and say, well, wait a second, General Odom said this, or General Cody said this. But back to Odom. He says, a number of reasons are given for not withdrawing soon and completely. Now, remember, just before this, he said that Al-Qaeda is dead meat if we get the hell out of the way. The Sunnis will butcher them, the Shia will butcher them, and the Kurds will butcher them, which puts the lie to every single rationale this little twit in the Oval Office continues to push out there, and this filthy, corrupt media of ours refuses to say Bush is a liar. And put the truth up. They won't do it. So anyway, Odom continues. A number of reasons are given for not withdrawing soon and completely. I have refuted them repeatedly before, but they have more lives than a cat. Let me try again to explain why they don't make sense. First, it is insisted that we must leave behind military training element with no combat forces to secure them. This makes no sense at all. The idea that U.S. military trainers left alone in Iraq can be safe and effective is flatly rejected by several NCOs and junior officers that I have heard describe their personal experiences. Second, it is insisted that chaos will follow our withdrawal. We heard that argument as the domino theory in Vietnam. Even so, the path to political stability will be bloody regardless of whether we withdraw or not. The idea that the United States has a moral responsibility to prevent this ignores that reality. We are certainly to blame for it, but we do not have the physical means to prevent it. American leaders who insist that it is in our power to do so are misleading both the public and themselves, if they really believe it. Third, naysayers insist that our withdrawal will create regional instability. This confuses cause with effect. Our forces in Iraq and our threat to change Iran's regime are making the region unstable. Those who link instability with a U.S. withdrawal have it exactly backwards. And there's more, and then he closes by saying, I implore you to reject these fallacious excuses for prolonging the commitment to U.S. forces to war in Iraq. It wasn't Odom one that, I don't know if he was cashiered early or decided to take an early retirement to be with his family or whatever the reason is that people have to put out there when they are given notice. Listen, your points of view, mister, don't jive with those of our illustrious dear leaders, so you're going to have to go. That's what happened to Fallon. It's astonishing stuff. Now, when we come back, after the next... Well, that's not for a couple of minutes, right? Okay. The next person that testified is General Richard Cody, the Army's Vice Chief of Staff. And according to the Washington Post today, senior Army and Marine Corps leaders said yesterday, this is on Tuesday. And as I go over this one, remember, this is what Bush and Cheney have done to our military. Senior Army and Marine Corps leaders said yesterday that the increase of more than 30,000 troops in Iraq and Afghanistan has put unsustainable levels of stress on U.S. ground forces and has put their readiness to fight other conflicts at the lowest level in years. Now, remember what these filthy, disgusting Republicans always say. They always say that Carter ruined the military. Clinton ruined the military. It's always a Democrat who has ruined the military. Now, this is what these Republican thugs are instructed to say by their overlords, the military-industrial complex. The fact is that the U.S. military has never, ever, not once in modern history, been destroyed. It is the huge maw into which we throw hundreds of billions of dollars repeatedly. Over and over again, there are certain conflicts that the United States will not win. We were in one in Southeast Asia. We are in one now. There is no way to win this kind of operation. The only thing, what Bush wants is to turn the region to glass. Let him drop 50 nuclear bombs and then we've won in this sick bastard's mind. But it's Bush and Cheney, it's the Republicans who have repeatedly destroyed our military. Over and over and over and over again. We have more on this when we come back. I'm Mike Malloy, this is Nova M. It's about 7 past the hour. This is the NOVAM Radio Network. I'm Mike Malloy. So yesterday, the top, not the top, but the Army's Vice Chief of Staff, General Richard Cody, testified before the House Armed Services Committee. All this is in preparation for the arrival next week of General David Petraeus. Today, General Odom retired, testified, and yesterday, General Richard Cody. He said that the heavy deployments that the Bush crime family insists on sending into Iraq are inflicting what General Cody calls incredible stress on soldiers and their families, and that these deployments pose what the general calls a significant risk to the nation's all-volunteer military. You know where he's going with this, don't you? Cody testified that, quote, when the 5 Brigade surge went in, that took all the stroke out of the shock absorbers for the United States Army. In other words, every single bit of reasonable, rational reserve is gone. George W. Bush and the thugs that are destroying this country have left us essentially unprotected. Do you realize that? Oh, I realize we have our nuclear arsenal and we have the Air Force and we have the Navy. But as far as the Army and the Marine Corps, do you realize what Bush and Cheney have done? They have destroyed the Army and the Marine Corps as mobile, fast-acting, effective fighting organizations. They have destroyed them. General Cody, Army Chief, Vice Chief of Staff, said yesterday in his testimony, quote, I have never seen our lack of strategic depth to be where it is today. Now, this is the guy who's been the senior Army official in charge of operations and readiness for the past 6 years. Oh, and he plans to retire this summer. Cody said the Army no longer has fully ready combat brigades on standby should a threat or conflict occur. We're screwed. That's what he's saying. Cody said, quote, the nation needs an airborne brigade, a heavy brigade, and a striker brigade ready for full spectrum operations, and we do not have that today, end quote. He went on to say that soldiers and Marines also lack training for major combat operations using their entire range of weapons. For example, artillerymen are not practicing firing heavy guns, but are instead doing counterinsurgency work as military police. General Robert Magnus, Assistant Commandant of the Marine Corps, also testified, and he said the Marine Corps' ability to train for potential conflict has been, quote, significantly degraded. Significantly degraded. The United States, by God, Marine Corps, significantly degraded by the Bush crime family. Look, you Republicans listening, do me a favor, will you? Really, haha, he chuckled. Don't ever get in my face again, you cowardly rat bastards, and tell me that the Democrats have destroyed the military or underfunded or done anything. The Democrats, to their credit or not to their credit, depending on your point of view, the Democrats have always made sure that there was a strong United States military. It's the Republicans. These cowardly, there's not 5 of these bastards who ever served their country on any level whatsoever. They are the ones who have destroyed the military. You are hearing it from Marine commandants, generals in the Army. You're seeing qualified flag rank officers saying to hell with it and leaving the military because of what these people have done. Do you Limbaugh suckers, do you not get this? Does this not penetrate your thick skulls? Do you not understand what has happened, what this son of a bitch in the White House has done over the past 6-7 years to every single aspect of American society, from the military to public health, everything? They've destroyed it all. Do you not understand that? You can't get that through your little pumpkin heads, can you? No matter what expert sits there and says to you, guess what? They have broken our military. Now, Cody, yesterday, added this. He said, given the current theater demand for Army forces, we are unable to provide a sustainable tempo of deployment for our soldiers and families. Soldiers, families, support systems, and equipment are stretched and stressed by the demands of lengthy and repeated deployments with insufficient recovery time. Equipment used repeatedly in harsh environments is wearing out more rapidly than programmed. Army support systems are straining under the accumulation of stress from 6 years of war. Overall, our readiness is being consumed as fast as we build it. And then he added this kicker, quote, if unaddressed, this lack of balance poses a significant risk to the all-volunteer force and degrades the Army's ability to make a timely response to other contingencies. Now, as VetVoice.com says, when Cody says this lack of balance poses a significant risk to the all-volunteer force, he's really saying we have three options. One, we can change course now and save everyone a lot of trouble. In other words, get the hell out of Iraq. Two, we can maintain our current course in Iraq and watch the Army disintegrate as it did during and after Vietnam. Or three, we can institute a draft. Now, the adjective all volunteer is a key part of the statement. He's implying that if the forces were not all volunteer, then there would be no significant risk. Because no sane officer would accept the disintegration of the Army. Cody is saying that if we want to keep up this thing in Iraq, we're going to have to move toward instituting a draft. It's that simple. Now, the sad part of this is that these cowardly, useless, murderous sons of bitches who now run this country are about 8 months short of being out of there and dumping this on a Democrat who is going to be the president. Which leads me to my own personal take, what I said a couple of months ago, and the more I think about it, the more it makes sense. Let McCain have it. There will be a draft. And once there is a draft, then, probably only then, will people in this country finally wake up to just one aspect of the destruction that the Republicans have done to us since 1994. I'm talking about recent history. And then and only then will people finally turn out in the tens of millions and say, no, we've had enough of this. And by then, I'm reasonably certain that McCain will have committed at least one or two or three impeachable acts, and perhaps then, with a veto-proof majority in the House and the Senate of Democrats, we can get rid of him, get rid of whomever, whatever sick son of a bitch he picks as a vice president, and start over. But when you have Marine general after Army general, retired and active duty, testify before Congress on the record in public saying, it's broken, it's ruined, we can't do this. The strain that's being put on families. What does this Bush bastard say? Oh, I just meet with the families and hug them and tell them, oh, thank you for your sacrifice. Cowardly son of a bitch doing this, ordering people into his toy war, his little masturbatory fantasy, so he can parade around. I'm war president. I'm war president. I'm war president. I got a legacy. This is the first war of the 21st century. I'm a war president. Jesus God.
The president has got to go. He's got to go. We want our country back. We're going to get it. Want to show him the door. Chemicals and nukes, you know, they never did appear. Yellow, orange, and red. just to keep us in fear. Said, hey, yeah, president has got to go.
Reality Radio for a Rational World. The Mike Malloy Show, only on Nova M Radio.
Past the hour. One last thing here, and then let's take some phone calls and get your take on some of the things we talked about tonight, okay? This is, excuse me. And by the way, what's going on here is with me is allergies that I have somehow picked up at this late stage in my life. And, of course, Atlanta, Georgia is the pollen capital of the known universe. So that's what you hear me struggling with. Now, I know you all have great remedies for how to combat allergies. Don't send them to me, okay? Because it just takes me a few days to get used to it, and then it goes away. Reg sent in to me this breaking news. It's not that old. The NATO allies have turned down George W. Bush's passionate pleas, is the way AP puts it, to put former Soviet republics, Ukraine and Georgia, on the path toward membership in NATO. Now, this is something that, that Putin has been saying, more or less, in his inimitable way. You do this, you son of a bitch, and we will start targeting anybody we choose to target. This and your missile defense system you want to put into what used to be our former sphere of influence? Huh? You want to do that, Georgie? We will, again, target our ICBMs on downtown Baltimore if you do this. Well, NATO, being a little bit more rational than George Bush, and NATO, the how many members are in NATO? 20, 25, 26? 26 nations in NATO, they make their decisions by consensus. It's not a dictatorial or an arrogant pissant situation like we have in this country where George Bush says, that's the way it's going to be. This way, I'm a decider. NATO makes, of the 26 members, one can stop any action that that NATO might be considering. One nation can say no. That's how consensus works. This is how the anti-nuke movement worked in this country all those years ago. Consensus decision-making. It's a good idea. It's a wonderful workable idea because then everybody's idea is incorporated into whatever the decision happens to be. Everybody's. And you do not move on your decision until everybody's opinion is incorporated. What a weird idea, huh? Yeah, of course. Well, NATO decided, no, we are not going to bring in Ukraine and Georgia into NATO. Now, they didn't say this, but I will say it. The North Atlantic Treaty Organization, wasn't that set up to be a force against the so-called Warsaw Pact nations, which were aligned with the Soviet Union, which no longer exists? None of this crap exists. But what NATO is used for now is to send troops to Afghanistan, which, you know, forgive me, but I thought that was way beyond the charter of NATO. Bill Clinton's use of NATO forces in Central Europe during the Serbian debacle, wasn't that in violation of the NATO charter? But never mind. Anyway, Bush had decided that this was going to be part of his legacy. Hey, we got we peeled all those countries off of the old Soviet Union and the Russian Federation, and we put them all in NATO. Son of a bitch, aren't I something? Aren't I just a pistol? Huh? Aren't I a pistol? German Chancellor Angela Merkel said, quote, we are convinced it's too early to grant these people, meaning Ukraine and Georgia. She didn't say people. I'm saying it. Pre-membership status. And so it stops. Now, the way Associated Press reports it, President Bush suffered a painful diplomatic setback Wednesday when NATO allies rebuffed his passionate pleas, yada, 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 yada. The decision to be made final tomorrow was sure to be cheered by Moscow, who cares, which heatedly opposed NATO's eastward expansion. But here's something for you, George. Croatia and Albania will be invited in as new members. How's that? There you go. Huh? You can't have Ukraine and Georgia, but you can have Croatia and Albania. That ought to keep you happy, you little twit. Somebody ask him real quick, where's Croatia? Where's Albania? What are they? What is an Albania? What is a Croatia? So just thought I would toss that into the mix. And when we come back after this break, we'll take your phone calls. Man. Change course, face the draft, or lose the Army. That's essentially what General Richard Cody, the Army Vice Chief of Staff, said yesterday. Change course in Iraq, institute a draft, or lose our Army. Why isn't Donald Rumsfeld hauled out of whatever spider hole he's in and put on trial before he implodes and his useless ass steps off this mortal coil? Why doesn't somebody suggest holding him responsible for what he's done?
I'm the decider. I'm the decider, and I decide what is best, and what's best is for Don Rumsfeld to remain as the Secretary of Defense.
Sitting in a White House garden, talking to the Lord. But my thoughts would be busy, busy hatching if I only had a brain. I am the...
You know, it'll take time to restore chaos and order, but we will.
Okay, you people are merciless about my idea of handing it to McCain. Okay. Just kidding. Prairie 2 says, where's Croatia and Albania? It's along the pipeline route up from Iran. That had to be a big slap in the face for Chuckle Nuts. He'll have to nuke somebody for that. Barry says, no, Albania is the capital of New York, and Croatians are those spotted fire dogs. And Reg says, regarding that stuff I read to you from the two generals, their testimony, Reggie writes, the American public did not hear the testimony of those two generals because the corporate media did not report what they said. Petraeus's testimony will be on every network newscast when he declares the surge a great success. So what's the use? I know, but there'll be a handful of us, right, Reg, who know the truth? People who go to the various websites that have the truth, including TVNewsLies.org. You can find it if you're interested. Excuse me. I hate pollen. Damn trees out here having sex all over the place, and I have to suffer for it. From our Aurora, Illinois Bureau Chief, Marianne. Mike, yes, General Odom, the one general who decided to forego his next star rather than curtail his judgment to suit Bush's vision in Iraq, he speaks the truth. Even at this late date, most of the Democrats in Congress will accept all the Republican premises of this illegal occupation of Iraq, including mislabeling it as a so-called war. But most of the Democrats will say that there is no military solution, only a political and diplomatic solution in Iraq, they still bring the generals in front of these committees. All of the presidential contenders refuse to give a definite withdrawal timeline, only that they will, quote, listen to the generals on the ground, end quote, those very generals who were willing to gain their next star by shaping their military judgment, so to speak, to Bush's liking. This debacle has been very much a bipartisan production since the Democrats, even the so-called new progressive from the Illinois 14th, are unable to make the following statements. One, the invasion and occupation violated international law, and the lies that brought these on are impeachable offenses. Two, if the Iraq solution is largely diplomatic and political, then it makes no sense to listen to the generals on the ground, the ones who got their promotions, by telling Bush what he wanted to hear. Three, make no further authorizations to fund this illegal debacle other than an orderly pullout of 3 to 6 months. And four, order the contractors and the mercenaries out and cut their funding immediately. Any argument against immediate U.S. withdrawal from Iraq is an argument against ever leaving Iraq. It will be bloody if we leave in 3 months. It will be bloody if we leave in 10 years. And our continued presence fuels the resentments, helps build up the inevitable civil war. But impeachment is off the table. We need to look forward, not backward. We need to reach across the aisle and find bipartisan solutions, and so on. Can one Democrat call out this farce for what it is? No. Marianne, our Aurora, Illinois bureau chief. To your phone calls, Paul is calling from Tucson, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. Hey, Paul.
Hey, Mike. Boy, that was quite a line that you give. That's pretty good. I like that.
Which is that?
Well, let's just start off about all of them, really, when you started quoting the generals.
Oh, yeah, their testimony.
Yeah, I was in the Marine Corps myself, man, and I was in, and I can tell you this, anytime a Marine Corps general says that, as testimony,
yeah,
you better listen to them, for crying out loud.
Yeah, but that's the thing. We have people making decisions, made decisions 6 years ago, who the closest they've ever been to a war was maybe playing with their toy soldiers when they were children, and they have sent, God only knows, how many hundreds of thousands of people to their deaths based on lies. And then you get these generals, the ones who are willing to speak out, even though it's risky, saying, this is insane.
Yeah,
this is crazy.
Insane. Because, you know, I heard the same word, just out of different mouth, the same thing they said about pulling out of now.
That's right.
And the only way they got anywhere on it is it took a big upheaval from the country. People really had to get involved. People had to kick the damn door down.
That's right.
So it's just a crime shame. I met somebody some time ago talking about the he met Clinton on, excuse me, he met Gore.
Right.
And he was in the Army, and he was the tanker. But they hate him because, you know, Gore did this and that and got rid of the tankers. And bullshit.
No, you can't. You can't, Paul. Paul, I realize you listen on Sirius, but once again, there's certain words, and I don't ask me why. It makes no sense to me, but we can't say them. We'll talk again, Paul. There's just a list of words that we can't say, and I'm sorry, because I know you listen on Sirius, but we're over the air, so it makes no sense to me either. The Vietnam thing, yeah, finally people brought it to an end. But at what cost? My God. 2-3 million Vietnamese, Cambodians. 58, almost 59,000 names on that wall in D.C. of American soldiers. Who knows how many wounded? For nothing. Seriously, for nothing! Nothing! Not a damn thing! Nothing! Every single man who died in that war, American, died for nothing. Every single Vietnamese who died, died defending their country. Isn't that a bitch? Isn't that hard to swallow? Huh? Every name on the wall in D.C. who died in Vietnam died for nothing. And now what do? We have factories in Vietnam because the labor's cheap. We have Nike factories in Vietnam building $200 sneakers and paying Vietnamese peasants $59 a month. God, don't start talking to me about Vietnam. It just infuriates me. How many do we have to have dead in Iraq? I don't know how Vietnam veterans who lost friends or lost their minds or lost an arm in that lying, miserable war, I don't know how they can stand it. I don't know how they can stand it. Especially when they see Colin Powell, who as Secretary of State a couple of years ago, dressed up like a Polynesian hula girl and danced on a stage in downtown Hanoi with other representatives from various governments in a musical comedy put on to foster the wonderful new relations between corporate America and corporate Vietnam. And it was Colin Powell, who was a lieutenant colonel in the Vietnam War, who deliberately slow walked for 10 months to report on what happened at My Lai. How can any American who is a veteran of actual duty in Vietnam, I'm not talking about Vietnam era veterans, but actual veterans of Vietnam, how can you stomach this? And how do you continue to vote Republican? It's insanity. And here we are again. History repeats itself first as tragedy, then as farce. Where are we now? Are we still in the tragedy or are we in the farce? Every time I see here in Georgia, because we have contributed a whole lot of dead to Bush's little enterprise, every time I see on the front page of the Journal Constitution one more picture of one more military funeral and one more 27-year-old widow standing there with her 6-year-old and her 2-year-old being handed a folded flag, I just want to scream. Just absolutely want to see somebody put on trial. Want to see somebody tried for war crimes. Want to see somebody sent to prison for the rest of their useless damn life.
Anger, he cries out, who is to blame for this war in Washington that's made a cold black runner? Why is my father's name etched here in this war?
That the unrest in the Middle East creates unrest throughout the region.
You do? Ted before the hour, thanks for putting up with my froggy voice tonight. It's from oak, maple, pine, what else? Cottonwood, pollen.
I know you're trying to get more fiber in your diet, but you really should cut back.
I know. I hate this. I've never been allergic to anything. I'll tell you something, to all you young people out there, getting old ain't for sissies. Thanks to Ian Huff, who engineered and answered your calls tonight, Billy Foster, our technical director, Ben Birch, Chris in Minnesota, Bob Alexander, Bridget Wolf, and Catherine Bay, all of whom have their individual responsibilities for putting together this program. I guess I should start adding Sharon, our military correspondent, who provides me with a considerable amount of military information. We'll have to check with her and see if she wants to be included. Program note, Tamara is our last night on the air until the 16th. Friday, and then next Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday will be handled by Mark Maron, Sam Cedar, and Peter Werby. Not necessarily in that order, but I am privileged little old talk show host to have talent of that caliber filling in while I'm gone. And also, if you are not a Nova M charter member, I just have one question for you. Why not? The advantages far outweigh the $10 a month that it costs. So, seriously, to a degree, we are listener supported. And we'd like to have you become a member. There are some advantages. I understand that our CEO, John Manzo, will on any given day come out and wash your car for you. I don't know. I just hear that. It may just be empty rumor. But go to NovaMradio.com if you would, please. Check out how and why it's important for you to become a member of the Nova M Radio family. I would appreciate it if you do that. Back to your phone calls. Tom is calling from KPHX, or I'm sorry, calling from Mesa, Arizona, listening on KPHX. Hey, Tom. Okay, well, I understand that. I get nervous sometimes, too, if I call a talk show. Jeremy is listening on Sirius Satellite Radio, calling from Maryland. Hey, Jeremy.
Hey, how you doing, Mr. Mallon?
I'm fine.
Well, I know it's you and your show. I'm going to try and make it quick. I really wish I had more time to talk to you because I'm not trying to be mean, but I don't understand how you think sometimes. My main point, though, two main points. First of all, I'd like to explain to you a little bit how stop loss works because your screener brought that up as a rebuttal to my other point, which is every person that's in the military right now, they might have been ordered to war, but they came in the military knowing that they were going to war because everybody had
All right. Let me stop you right there, Jeremy, and,
okay,
and show you where your argument is wrong. So many of the people who are in the military in combat zones now for second and third deployments joined the National Guard. They did not
join.
Wait, let me finish.
Okay.
Let me finish. They did not join the regular army. Also, they joined the reserves. They did not join the regular army. When you are in the National Guard or the reserves, you have the clear understanding that if the country is attacked, you will defend. You also have the clear understanding if there is a national emergency, you will be called out to take care of the problems the result of that national emergency. People do not join the National Guard, Jeremy, to go into a combat zone. Now, do you agree with that?
No, I don't, because I'm a military member. I'm an active duty.
All right, Jeremy,
right now, but
tell me a National Guardsman. I don't know how. I just don't know how to talk to someone like you, because if somebody wanted to go into combat, they would join the regular army. They wouldn't join the reserve or the National Guard. You say you're in the military. Either you're lying or you don't understand what you're talking about. If I want to go someplace where there is a hot war, I do not join the National Guard. I join the Marine Corps. I join the regular army. I go get my training, I take my weapon, and I go kill. That is not why people join the Tennessee National Guard, the Iowa National Guard, the Florida National Guard. I'm in no mood to hear your crap, so goodbye. And people do not join the reserve to do that. You've got to get your head out of your rectum and start thinking clearly. I just can't tolerate that. And I don't have to. I hear that argument so many times from right-wingers. Well, this is an all-volunteer force. Okay, so what? Did they volunteer to go into a hot combat zone to do urban warfare? Did they volunteer to get in the middle of a civil war?
And I wonder if they volunteered to illegally preemptive strike, make a preemptive strike against a nation that didn't attack us. I mean, that's a problem that I don't care if they all volunteered. They didn't volunteer to
violate the law.
To go into an unconstitutional war against a country that had taken no provocative action.
Sure. So, you know, when I hear that, I have no patience. I don't give a damn if you're in the military or not. You come across like a half-witted jerk when you make a statement like that. I'll see you tomorrow night. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M.